Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Texas Tribune Tripcast for the first week of June. My name is Ben Philpott, sitting in for Elise Hugh Stiles, who is out on a honeymoon somewhere, I believe. As always, I'm here with fellow Tribcasters Evan Smith, who is a Yankees fan.
Hello, Braves fan.
We have St. Louis
That's the
Cardinals.
Best you can do.
We have St. Louis Cardinals fan Ross Ramsey.
So if you didn't hate politics, now you can hate baseball too.
And we have with us Reeve Hamilton, who went to Vanderbilt and therefore does not follow any sports.
Right. Exactly. I'm a fan of nothing.
Doesn't like sports at all, in fact.
This week on the Tribcast, we're going to be talking political fundraising, a audit of TxDOT redistricting, and the lovely TCEQ and the politics of pollution. Why don't we kick things off with Ross and political fundraising? This is the time to raise that money to spend in the fall, right?
Yeah, we're in the money primary right now. The first reports, or I guess an important report comes out in mid-July. And this is when all the candidates for Texas and for federal office file how much money they've made through the end of June. And you really get an idea what everybody's arsenal is, who's really serious, who's really been raising money. In particular, this is a place to watch the governor's race to see whether Rick White and Rick Perry and Bill White are raising money, where Kay's money went. A lot of Hutchison's money is actually going to Perry. He's done a pretty good job of locking that up.
So you would basically look at the people who supported Hutchison during the primary and
right.
look for their names on the Perry list.
Right. That $23, $25 million that Hutchison raised came from a bunch of people who are either doubling down and now going with Bill White or are really, really sorry and are coming back to Rick Perry. And, you know, one of the things we'll find out is that.
Do you know of any of the ones who have thrown in with White?
Not really.
Can you name one?
Off the top of my head, cold, no.
No, but you suspect there are some.
Yeah, I'm sure there are some. Yeah. You know, there's some people who just aren't happy
this
with
is,
the government.
This is the point in the conversation where we say, Katie Bacon,
yeah, right.
If you have a name, call us.
Oh, we'll get a call that says, I can't believe you didn't name, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, you'll see that in challenger races, you'll see you know, whether the challenges are serious. I mean, it really is an early sign of support and an early sign of strength or not strength. You know, Barbara Radnofsky and Greg Abbott. Greg Abbott's going to have more money. Does she have enough money to compete? Things like that. So,
and a well-funded challenger doesn't necessarily guarantee a competitive race.
Right.
I'm thinking about Michael Skelly.
Right.
The wind power and clean energy entrepreneur
wind,
from
right.
Houston, who last time ran for Congress against John Culberson and was perceived to be competitive on the basis of the fact that he had money in a bank, but ultimately it just didn't turn out to be a race that made.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So what's going on if you have money or if they think you have money right now is June is the month. It's the deadline's the end of the month for these fundraising reports. They're very important to the candidates. They're very important to the campaigns. And so all the fundraisers are banging on the phones trying to get people out. You know, give me $1,000. Give me $2,500. Give me, give me, give me, give me, give me.
Yeah.
So if you have money or they think you have money, you have a target side on you now.
So kind of along these same lines, in terms of gauging strength and fundraising, what about the questions that have come up about how much money the state Republican Party has or how much it doesn't have, how much it has or has not been able to raise over the last couple of years?
And whether that matters.
And whether that matters and whether or not this, you know, whether or not when we come out of the other end of the summer, there will be a number that will show us whether it mattered.
Well, you know, the question on the party right now is sort of confused because Kathy Adams, who's the chairman of the Texas Republican Party right now, has two challengers. Their convention is at the end of next week. And so they're raising all kinds of hell about how much money the party owes, whether it's raising money, whether it needs to raise money.
Whether it can pay the bill for the convention.
Right.
And whether she's pulling a whole nothing to see here, keep moving deal.
Right, right.
When in fact, there's actually something going on beneath the surface. That's what's alleged, at least.
The
and
bigger question is, does it matter? You know, parties used to be the organizing force. They were the people who kept the data banks of all the voters and which doors to knock on and which doors to avoid and all of that kind of stuff all over the state. More and more, that's really a function of the big campaigns and a governor's campaign, especially when you've had a governor in office for as long as Perry has been in office and has been building an organization for as long as he has. The organization that used to be or that would normally be in the party is now really in the governor's office.
Does Perry need
he doesn't
the
really
party
need,
for anything?
No.
The answer is probably no.
Right.
Party probably needs him more than he needs it.
Right, right.
And does anybody cast a vote or not cast a vote on the basis of the party? The party apparatus, I mean.
Probably not on the basis of the party apparatus. They do on the basis of the party flag for sure. I mean, people vote straight ticket votes. Some people vote, you know, if I don't know whether this candidate or that, I'll vote my party.
Right, but I'm thinking specifically. So if the Kathy Adams thing turned out to be a legitimate scandal, which right. we don't have any reason to know that it is. It's just been alleged by one of the people right. running against her for chair.
Right.
Would anybody who was thinking about voting for Rick Perry suddenly go, you know what? I think that chair of the party is a crook.
The question,
therefore, I'm going to vote for Bill White.
The question really is, does the party... Is the party of benefit ordinarily to candidates who, because of this stuff, it won't be of benefit to, right? Does the party, does all this financial stuff keep the party from doing something to the benefit of Republican candidates that yeah. they're dependent on? And I think not so much.
What about the convention coming up at the end of the month?
The convention coming up at the end of the month, you know, the Texas Republican Party has this, is the largest political convention in the world. It's bigger than any of the national stuff. So it's 14,000 delegates. A bazillion. I didn't even know there were that many red, white, and blue sequins.
But, and it's,
know,
it's in Dallas.
It's in Dallas. Yeah. It's a big event. It's a big fundraiser, and you know they you know, you want it to pay for itself. You want it to be an organizing tool. You want everybody to come out, and you know, your 14,000 people to leave there, and each of them get five friends to go vote. You know, and you know, it's classic political organizing. I'm not sure it has that big of an effect anymore. That it, you know, that it did 20 years ago or 30 years ago or 40 years ago.
And because the candidates will want to come and have good airtime, right? Good speaking
right.
time.
Right.
And of course, if they don't end up having the money to put it on, which doesn't sound like a legitimate,
they'll put it on. The
fear.
Question is whether they're going to have a debt. They'll put on the they're going to put on the convention.
Right. Well, yeah. I was going to say they always have the option of going
it's
to
whether they do it on the credit card or whether they do it out of the savings account. But they'll put on the convention.
They can always go to Deborah Medina's party down the street, which is going
well,
on.
Right.
At the same
time. Reeve did right. blog about the fact that Medina is holding a kind of, you know, sort of what slam dance. Is to Sundance. Medina is pulling on the Republican Party by now. I have to believe that the Republican Party would do well to embrace the Medina people and somehow figure out how to give them a reason to be at their convention.
They
but,
right.
but not.
They said, I mean, Medina applied to have a booth at their convention and they turned her away because she sued them in 2008. And they say we have a policy against granting anyone a booth. That has sued us in the past.
Which apparently wasn't a policy until Deborah Medina wanted a booth.
Right.
Right.
What benefit accrues to the Republican Party for pissing off Deborah Medina and her followers? Maybe none, but maybe they think that the Medina movement is so small at this point that there's no downside.
Eventually, you have to be additive in politics. You have to bring in the people that you disagree with slightly so that you can, you know, fight your real enemies. And if they're fighting right. inside, you know, that's not to their benefit. That's really, you know, kind of what's been going on in the Republican Party this year is whether they keep this tension between the party regulars and the people who've kind of broken out into the Tea Parties and the, you know, kind of the middle finger vote. Deborah Medina is part of that. You need to pull those people all back together if you're going to beat the other party.
Back to the fundraising thing, are the Tea Party candidates who are running finding that their ability to raise money is as good as the conventional Republican candidates who are running?
Not so far, but their ability to organize is fantastic. I mean, they've been really, really good at organizing. Charles Perry, who is the guy who defeated Delwin Jones in Lubbock and four other counties right. out in West Texas, didn't really, you know, didn't do anything particularly impressive in terms of fundraising, but they turned out huge votes, both in the primary and in the primary runoff. And, you know, ultimately the money is just to get votes out. You know, ultimately yeah. you're trying to get votes out. If you can do it without money, more power to you. But the Tea Party's been strong in some places, in spots like that one in Collin County, as an organizing force, but not as a fundraising force.
Well, let's skip on here to the next topic on the agenda. Nice segue, right? How about
very professional, Ben?
Thank you very much. Speaking of Delwin Jones,
where's Elise?
Speaking of Delwin Jones, you have to drive on state highways to get all the way to Lubbock. And Reeve,
you had to drive on a state highway to transition that topic.
Right, gee. I think you went off road there.
That's not even the topic I was thinking you were going to do.
Oh. So what about the text?
Hey, Ben, I think it's going well so far.
I think Elise has a safe job here. So the TxDOT's going to be audited.
TxDOT's
up with that?
TxDOT has been audited.
Oh, been audited. What's up?
Ben playing the role of Ben.
is
there an exit here?
They're going to respond to their audit next week. Basically, they agreed to undergo a stem to stern sort of run through of their company by this consulting firm, Grant Thornton. The results came out at the end of last week. Sort of be careful what you ask for. The report was 628 pages long. And I think Senator Kirk Watson said that it didn't show anything really new for people that follow transportation, but if people that don't follow transportation want to read something interesting about one of their government agencies, it's sort of something to see it all in one place. Basically, the gist was TxDOT is a deeply department with a deeply entrenched culture that may sort of be out of touch with the modern reality. This is a department that's been around for 93 years. And sort of
are
the
they
demands
they
on
have dementia. What are they saying?
Well, no, just the TxDOT way sort of became quickly set decades ago. The reality of transportation in terms of funding is much more volatile. What else? People just have higher expectations of being able to get places this many ways faster.
So they just haven't kept up with the times.
And they haven't kept up with the times. It also says that people don't trust them. They're broke. Their leadership is not sort of well positioned to change things. They need to bring in new leaders that can be change agents. So I mean,
mostly a really optimistic report. It sounds like.
Yeah,
but also as we've said, stuff we knew.
Yeah.
You know, TxDOT's broke. Not exactly a spoiler alert.
Do we have any idea what they're going to say? I mean, how do you respond to that? We've got problems. Or
Deirdre DeLisi, the chair of the Transportation Commission, responded to this or?
No? They're going to respond next week. I mean, they're going to take some.
They're taking
some time to read I'm sure every word of all 628 pages.
They will. They're engineers. Yeah. They'll read everything.
Yeah. Right. Well, that was another part of it. Is that they? One of the criticisms in the report is that they hire too many engineers. It's too engineer heavy over there. But
they're roads. What?
But they got to do other stuff too.
How much did they pay for this audit?
Apparently paid by word count. 628 pages.
No, not exactly beach
cow.
Reading. Is it available on the Kindle?
That's right.
Maybe
it's good beach reading.
Can I get the audio audit read by Chris Lippincott?
Yeah, you
could
download it on your iPad, but it might take all day.
Exactly. Yeah. That's great.
Well, I mean, what they're saying now is, you know, we are committed to sort of looking at this and looking into changing how we need it. And it does not really criticize the commissioner and the commission as much as it does the sort of executive leadership of the department.
Does it go anywhere toward, you know, I mean, Evan did a Trib Live interview with Deirdre DeLisi, and one of the most interesting things in that, I thought, was when she said that, you know, in order to maintain, this phrasing right, in order to maintain our current level of congestion, we have to spend something on the order of $315 billion between now and 2030.
Right.
And
which we have.
And even if we had the money, we don't have the building capacity to build all of the stuff we would have to build in order to maintain the current level of congestion. So
the key was current level,
like an ad for satellite radio, you know, something to do on the highway, right? But
right. And that was current level. That wasn't even accounting for
improvement.
Growth and
right.
improvement. It's exactly incredible.
So I'm curious if there's anything in this audit, that's really sort of toward. Is it all about the organization of the agency and about how moribund it is and all of that kind of stuff, or is there some kind of solution? Or do they recommend any kind of solutions about, by the way, you should do A, B, and C?
Yeah. Well, they. They recommend sort of a more direct approach to projects. One of the things they talk about is how right now TxDOT sort of sends out and starts working on lots of projects, sort of assuming that certain ones won't come through. But there's not a lot of organization for sort of which ones, and it's not very targeted. So maybe
sounds like our staff. Somehow.
Yeah. So maybe one of their things is, you know, be a little more direct in your planning and execution of certain things, and maybe your money will be. Better spent there. That's just one thing. I mean, that's part of it. But part of the problem, they mentioned the 2030 committee and the $315 billion, and part of the problem is just that people, they know that there's this problem and they don't trust them to come up with the money and use it correctly, which is sort of an exterior problem, a perception problem.
And, you know, that stifles transportation agencies all the time. Cap Metro was ready to build a trolley line or however you want to call it, light rail line in Austin in 2000. And basically the voters said, you know what, we don't trust you with $100 bazillion, whatever that bond they were trying to get. And so they voted no.
You got us into this mess and cost us your trust. And so we don't trust you to get us out of this mess.
Which is fine, except who do you trust?
Because it's not going to get better unless you trust somebody.
I mean, this is one of the fundamental contradictions about the way people view government is they hate government, but they don't have an alternative that they can put in place of the people they don't trust. And so nothing happening is not an acceptable option.
And speaking of not trusting government agencies, the Obama administration, the EPA rather, does not necessarily trust the TCEQ.
Better transition, Ben.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. I'm working improving. Yeah.
Right. Well, the TCEQ story is actually interesting on a lot of levels. The Obama administration's EPA has come in and said we're going to strip the permitting power from the from the state of Texas over a particular facility in Corpus Christi, but they're identifying a larger problem that apparently has, you know, this is not new to.
And saying that if the larger problem isn't addressed, they will take over.
They will come in and do more. They're threatening.
Well, this to is the whole state.
The first step, and the potential consequence of this is enormous. It's become an issue in the governor's race. Today we've already had dueling press releases, you know, Perry attacking the EPA, White attacking Perry over this. You know, and you've got the larger question of whether TCEQ, absent the government's involvement in permitting and other things in the state, is the TCEQ functioning properly? The number of enforcement actions, administrative as opposed to court-enforced, administrative enforcement actions, the lesser of the two enforcement actions against polluters over the last decade, that's actually doubled. There was an audit in about 2003 that took TCEQ to task for not being aggressive enough in attacking polluters, and so they responded by stepping up their enforcement actions. And I think they've doubled over the last 10 years the number of actions against polluters. But the fines levied against polluters are still so small that they barely qualify as a deterrent. I think in the story that we published this week, Ross, Exxon is the most often cited polluter of any company in Texas over the last 10 years. I think 92 different citations, enforcement actions against Exxon in the last 10 years. But the amount that Exxon has had to pay in penalties averages out to $158,000 a year over those 10 years. This is a company with 19
That's an accounting
Brazilian
error.
Well, and, you know, dollars in revenues just last year. So the question is whether, as it was posed by one critic of TCEQ in the story, you know, from a bottom line standpoint, it may be better for some of these companies to simply pay the penalty.
Right. It may be cheaper to do the infraction and take the fine than to do it right and do it the other way. It's you know, there's a political sidebar here. I want to point out that if Perry is able to rail successfully against the federal government on behalf of the state, and if White finds himself in the position of defending the federal government and saying the state ought to do better,
right,
Perry's winning because he's painting Bill White into the Washington
hole. Step into my lair.
I believe Kay Hutchison has been here.
Yeah.
You know, if you can identify, if you're in the Perry campaign, you want to identify the Democrats and Bill White with Washington.
Yeah.
This is a nice little background.
So you want that snapshot of White hugging Obama.
Right.
And a snapshot of White hugging the EPA will do.
Right.
As an alternative.
You think Perry's praying that the Department of Education comes in and takes over the school system? Or
I just, you know, if you're going to rail against the federal government and you know, if Perry's going to take on the federal government, which he's clearly been doing for the last year or so, you know, not
he's
getting
ammunition. Fed up with them.
Right, he's fed up. That's exactly right. Right. You know, so you've got
in italics, if, available as an audiobook read by Chris Lippincott.
The trap for the Democrats, the trap for White here, is defending or attacking Perry for attacking Washington. That's a losing position.
Yeah, but see, this is I agree with all this. I would gently move the conversation though to this. Does anybody actually give a crap about pollution as a political issue? In other words, of all the things that a political race, Perry versus White or whatever else, will be litigated over, is pollution really going to be the issue? I think that the majority of people walk out of their house in the morning, breathe the air, oh, I got breath in my lungs, get in the car, drive. Most people don't actually look at TCEQ and it's either small fines or insufficient number of enforcement actions or just pollution generally. It's not even in the top 10 issues, I think.
Well, if you're in around the Barnett Shale thing with this other TCEQ stuff that came out this week,
right?
You're not just breathing in air, you're also breathing in lots and lots of benzene, which they failed to disclose a while ago.
Right, and I will grant you that in certain cases, this is an issue, but boy.
But this political argument isn't about pollution.
I'm not sure.
This EPA TCEQ argument,
it's a Washington
as a political
versus
matter,
Texas
is not
thing.
About pollution. It's about Washington versus Texas, and that's exactly where I'm going. You know, Bill White might be better off arguing about pollution.
He might be, you know, have a press conference with Wendy Davis about benzene.
Right.
Wendy Davis' staff, by the way, I hear is awesome. That's a little inside joke here in the Tripcast. but in all seriousness, I think that there's an issue here to be discussed by these guys about how much you push the TCEQ issue and expect that voters are really going to care.
Right.
How do you personalize this for them?
Right.
Except in cases like what Reeve is talking about, it's a real problem.
Yeah, it's much easier for Perry to just throw up federal government than it is for Bill
Washington's
White
in our business. We should get them out of here. White's in a position of saying, you know, if you were doing your job, nobody would be in your business. a little bit nuanced, and it's, you know.
Well, but the interesting thing is, on another issue, immigration, you have the opposite conversation going on. Brandi Grissom wrote a story, I thought a really wonderful story, last week about what's happening in Hudspeth County.
Right.
Where the commissioner's court in a very far west Texas county of 3,000 people, 75% Hispanic, the commissioner's court voted to support the Arizona immigration law. And the county commissioner who introduced the resolution, his argument is, what's wrong with the federal government enforcing the law? He's actually taking the position that the federal government ought to be in our stuff.
Right.
And in fact, that is one of the arguments that not only that fellow, but a lot of other people, often Republicans, often critical of the current immigration policy, they believe the federal government ought to be more
including the governor
in our stuff,
including the governor.
So,
although
depending
upon the
issue,
for national guard troops, right. And right, right.
But I think it's only one of three things that the governor thinks the federal government should do. They should
what are
deliver,
the other two?
They should deliver the mail. They should protect our country with a strong military, and they should lock down our borders.
Wow.
And he typically says then, two out of three ain't bad.
Right.
Right.
Well, one out of three. He says, yeah. Well, we've got a strong military.
He doesn't even like the mail.
My mail service
is actually very bad. His copy of Food and Wine is apparently arriving.
That's right.
Now, so that, at least in that respect, the mail's fine.
Well played.
Yeah.
Well, then we'll just wrap everything up with
another magnificent transition.
Well, yeah, exactly. Thank you. Well, you know, hand gestures, they throw me off. Yeah. So, you know, one other thing going on, talking about big messes, redistricting's back in the news a little bit this week. There's going to be a redistricting hearing here in Austin.
Who's the chairman of that committee?
Well, that's Delwyn Jones.
That's the transition I was going for earlier.
Yeah, I know. I figured that out after
he
fact.
He was throwing you a line,
know,
Ben.
Here's the rope. Yeah. I hung myself. He's having a committee hearing. He's a lame duck. He lost in the Republican primary to Chris Perry.
Charles Perry,
out in Lubbock. I got the first letter right.
Lead singer of Journey, actually. Good.
That'd be great to lose to Steve Perry. But, you know, they're just going over demographics and basic stuff, kind of leading into the real fun, which is when somebody goes into a back room and draws a secret map and throws it out in the middle of the night. But, you know, I did just a little story this week trying to look at maybe kind of the non-politics of it, which is the fact that the state, 57% of the growth we've had over the last 10 years is in the I-35 corridor from Oklahoma to Mexico. And we've had another giant jump in Hispanic population. And one thing that I found out yesterday is, you know, there were no Hispanic opportunity districts created. Opportunity districts meaning a place where there is a chance to elect a Hispanic candidate. None were created in the 2000 round. So now we're 20 years out from the last time a Hispanic opportunity district was created, and the Hispanic population has just grown so large in those 20 years.
Right. You know, the things that they don't know so far, we're building a voluminous case file. And we're starting, redistricting is every 10 years. They're basically building the files that will be in court 2 or 3 years hence. But a couple of things that we don't know. We don't know exactly what the population count is for the state of Texas. And exactly where the populations, we have estimates, the baseline for these is 10 years old. So some of the estimates will be wrong, but it's clear that the big growth in Texas is, if you imagine a triangle from DFW down to Austin, San Antonio, over to Houston, and then dip the tip of Texas, the bottom end of Texas.
And that's 90% of the projected growth.
And so those are the areas that are going to grow. Another thing we don't know is what the population of the country is. And this is important because it determines how many new congressional seats Texas will get. So it looks like
it's not just dependent upon our growth. It's dependent upon growth.
Texas has grown faster relative to the rest of the country. We think we're going to get 3. We might get 4 new congressional seats. And then you look at the state like sort of a waterbed, and you sort of see where population has grown and where it has declined. So in West Texas, population has actually declined in some areas, and in some areas it hasn't kept up with the rest of the state. West Texas is going to lose seats. South Texas is going to gain seats around the very bottom of the state. Suburban areas,
both congressional and legislative.
Congressional and legislative, right, House and Senate. Now, because we're getting 4 new congressional seats, the areas that are going to lose people might not lose as badly as they would if we were keeping the same number of seats. We'll have four extra congressmen to spread around, right? So West Texas might not lose as many seats. But when you get into the Texas House, there's a chance that you lose two and maybe three West Texas seats in the Texas House.
Right. Unless you draw finger districts from Dallas-Fort Worth.
Whose seats are in risk?
To more popular more populous parts of the state. Well, the
Swinford.
The thing in redistricting is always if you're a freshman, that's you don't have any chits. And so the Swinford seat in Dumas, the Charles Perry seat in Lubbock, and the John Frullo seat in Lubbock are all held by freshmen. You know, if you're a freshman, you're walking around with a kick me sign during redistricting. And, you know, if they're looking around, if John Smithy wants to stay in office, if, you know, all of these other veteran legislators in West Texas want to stay in office, the freshmen are the ones with the kick me sign.
And the theory would be that those three would become two.
Or that those three would become one.
Right.
Right.
Is there any chance of avoiding the partisan politics and having the whole thing done by technocrats like James Baker wants?
This is very, you know, this is one of those truisms. It's trite, but it's true. You can't take the politics out of politics. This is one of the most political things that they do, and they're not going to let go of it and hand it over to a bunch of technocrats.
And there is, you know, you talk to different people who will be drawing those maps behind the scene, and they will say, well, you know, the one thing that maybe will keep this from being a huge mess like it was in 2003 is the fact that you have a Department of Justice under a Democrat up in Washington. I think the first one, they said, this is the first time the Department of Justice has been under a Democratic administration since Texas went under the Voting Rights Act.
Right.
So you go back, so 2000, it would have been under Bush Elder. Mm-hmm. Bush.
Bush the Younger.
Bush the Younger. Then
Bush the Elder.
90, it would have been Bush the Elder. 80, it would have been Reagan.
70
would have been Nixon.
And
there you go.
So, you know, not that they expect.
It's like Memento. We tell the story backwards, Reed. Keep up.
Well, I've never heard of any of those people.
I don't
doubt
it.
That's my line. Not that anybody is necessarily predicting what the Justice Department would or would not do, but the simple idea that it's a Justice Department under a minority president might not be as excited about gigantic districts ranging from Austin to the Mexican border.
I think this is, you know, this all really comes down to advantage. When people are drawing political maps, they draw them to their own advantage, and it's a straight power play. If you have the ability to draw the map, you draw the map. And so the Republicans have the upper hand three ways. They have both houses of the legislature right now. They have all five members of the legislative redistricting board that draws maps for the legislature if the legislature fails to do so.
Which they probably
most
will.
Of the judges who would ultimately consider any Texas redistricting were appointed by Republican presidents. And the only hole card that the Democrats have is that they have to get what's called preclearance from the Justice Department for any new map, and that's a Democratic Justice Department. But it still gets litigated, and you know, the
law is the law.
The law is the law, and the odds right now lean toward the Republicans.
So one quick question then before we go. Why then are there talks of an agreement going ahead and saying, you know, we're going to look towards adding two Hispanic Opportunity congressional seats in the Valley? When there is so much advantage on the other side?
Because the Congress is sort of negotiating over who's going to lose seats and who's going to win seats, and they're playing an inside game. You know, the members of Congress who want to stay are trying to help the other members of Congress who want to stay. And, you know, this is a deal, I guess, kind of came to light with Evan's story between Lamar Smith and Henry Cuellar sort of negotiating to do this stuff. Neither Lamar Smith nor Henry Cuellar gets a crayon. They don't get to draw any of the maps. They get to beg the legislature to draw maps for them, but they don't have a say in this thing.
Well, gosh, I think that'll do it. Hopefully, Elise will be back.
Thank God.
Hopefully, Elise will be back next week. For Evan, Ross, and Reeve, I'm Ben, and we'll see you next week.